Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is Anthony Kern. He is a Republican member of the Arizona State Senate. Mr. Kern is currently running to be the Republican nominee for Arizona's 8th congressional district. And if he wins that race, it will not be his first time in our nation's capital. In fact, here's a video of him at the Capitol building 3 years ago. You can see him there walking through the rafters along with the rest of the January 6th rioters. Now, Anthony Kern actually had a special interest in being at the Capitol that day. In addition to being among the throngs of people storming the building, Mr. Kern was also one of Arizona's fake electors. He was one of the Arizona Republicans who submitted fake documents certifying Donald Trump as the winner of the 2020 election. Kern even tweeted on January 6th that it was D-Day in D.C. and that he was there to support Arizona's and America's duly elected president, Donald Trump. And today, Anthony Kern, the man himself, would like to be a duly elected member of Congress representing the people of Arizona's 8th District. Now, OK, this is a safely Republican seat. But if you are a Republican voter in Arizona's 8th, who maybe doesn't want to be represented by a Capitol rioter like Anthony Kern, there are other options. Because also running in that primary is Blake Masters, the election-denying, Unabomber-praising candidate who was very publicly humiliated in his 2022 bid to be a senator from Arizona. But if you are not a Blake Masters fan, you could also vote for this man, Abe Hamadeh. Abe Hamadeh is also an election denier. He was the Republican candidate to be Arizona's attorney general, also in 2022. And he, too, lost that race. Abe Hamadeh was edged out by Democrat Chris Mays. Hamadeh then denied the results of that election because that is what Arizona Republicans do when they lose, and then ended up getting sanctioned by the Arizona Supreme Court. So a lot of election deniers to choose from in the Republican primary for Arizona's 8th district this year. But if you like the election denial and just don't like the party, well, there is still another option. Libertarian Jacob Chansley. If his name sounds familiar, it's because Jacob Chansley is the QAnon shaman, the man who launched a million screenshots as a fur-clad Capitol rioter. So that is what electoral politics looks like now in conservative districts like Arizona's 8th. This is the reality that Republicans fashioned for themselves by refusing to hold Donald Trump and his allies accountable for the events of January 6th. They stormed the Capitol, and now they are storming the Republican Party. Donald Trump has made supporting these rioters an explicit part of his platform for president. He refers to the people arrested for their actions that day as hostages and plays recordings of them singing at his rallies. He promises to free them as one of his first acts if he is reelected. And how have Republicans responded? By trying to give Trump his own airport. This week, a group of House Republicans introduced a bill to rename Washington's Dulles Airport after Donald Trump. They want the airport in Washington, D.C. to be named after the only president to ever inspire an attack on Washington, D.C. Recently, one of the few Republicans who held Trump accountable after January 6th, Liz Cheney, had this to say about her former colleagues.
I think you had some elected Republicans who believed that he would just disappear, who thought, you know, we don't have to actually speak against what he did. We don't have to actually stand up to him because, you know, certainly he will fade away. And obviously that didn't happen. And I think when people look back at this time, at the history of this time, those elected officials who know the danger that he poses, who know that what he's saying is a lie, who know that he threatens fundamentally our democratic system, but yet have enabled him and have gone along, you know, they will be judged very harshly by history.
They are going to be judged very harshly by history. Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell is one of those Republicans who had to learn the hard way that Donald Trump would not just disappear. McConnell has already had to announce his retirement as Republican Senate leader. He has had to endure 3 years of Trump mocking him in public and launching racist attacks against his wife. But still, Mitch McConnell crouches in fear of Trump, refusing to even speak his name. Here he was in an interview this week with a local radio personality in his home state of Kentucky.
Do you have any contact at all with Donald Trump, the presumptive nominee for the Republican
Party? Oh, I've got my hands full dealing with the Senate.
You guys don't talk. And eventually, there's going to have to be
Spending my time on the Senate.
Okay. No texts? No nothing? Okay.
I thought we were going to talk about the new basketball
coach. Well, we are.
I thought we were going to talk about the new basketball coach. If you were wondering how Donald Trump could go from stoking an insurrection to once again being the Republican Party's nominee for president, this is how. The Republican Party, on whole, has abandoned all responsibility here. Republicans either declare their blind loyalty to Trump or they say nothing at all. In a new piece out today, Atlantic's editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg explains why he believes that the people who are most responsible for Trump's continued viability are the Republican senators who voted to acquit him for January 6th. In particular, the Republicans who knew better but were too afraid to say so. Goldberg recalls an interview he did with one of those Republicans, former Ohio Senator Rob Portman, who he interviewed on stage at the Aspen Ideas Festival in 2022. I do want to ask you directly, I said when we sat on stage, given what you know now about what happened on January 6th, do you regret your vote to acquit in impeachment? Portman immediately expressed his unhappiness with what he took to be an outre question. You have just surprised me, he said, complaining that I hadn't told him beforehand that I would ask him about Trump. I eventually pivoted the discussion to the topic of bridges in Ohio, but Portman remained upset, rushing off stage at the end of the conversation to confront the leaders of the festival who tried to placate him. Initially, I found his defensive behavior odd, but I surmised from subsequent conversations with members of the Republican Senate caucus that he, like others, felt a certain degree of shame about his continued excuse-making for the authoritarian hijacker of his beloved party. Joining me now is Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, which was just awarded the National Magazine Award for General Excellence for the third year running by the American Society of Magazine Editors, which is an amazing thing. And as someone who once was very proud to call themselves an Atlantic writer, I am.
And
you're
in the
best.
Future.
You're the best. And future.
And
if I'm lucky.
Future. Yeah.
It is a big honor.
The future is bright for magazines.
It is. Bright for The Atlantic. And I got to say, part of the reason you're getting these awards is because you have writing and analysis and astute observation like what we just read in, you know, ellipsist form. On this program.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm going to leave while I
get
out of here.
Yeah, and thanks for coming to the program.
Yeah, this is great. So far, it's gone great for me.
It is never not important to talk about how we got to this place.
True.
And I thought your recollection of your time on stage with Portman was so revealing. And I wonder, as someone who's kind of in retrospect, in hindsight, sort of evaluated the man's kind of psychology in that moment, whether you think Republicans like McConnell and Portman have any kind of internal monologue with themselves, whether there's any sense that the shame they're feeling deserves more than just burying the truth, and whether there needs to be more public contrition.
So, to borrow the very dark Russian expression, all souls are a dark forest. We don't know what's going on in Mitch McConnell's mind.
Yeah. And he's a
harder target, yeah. I think, maybe more impenetrable. First of all, people can convince themselves of anything,
sure,
as we know. So put that aside for a second. I do think, and this is not based on my armchair psychoanalysis.
Sure.
This is based on talking to people
in the Senate.
In the Senate, who, including some of those who voted to convict, there were seven Republicans who voted to convict, and they're all friends together, everybody in the caucus, so they know who came up to them privately and said, "Oh man, I wish I could do that, what you did." And you know, some of them report conversations like, well, you could have. And I said, no, I couldn't have. And then they explain whatever it is, that fear, physical fear, mm-hmm. fear for their families, fear for their careers. I mean, people who are honest say, look, I come from X state, and if I come out and vote to convict this guy for fomenting the insurrection, I'm going to lose my job, mm-hmm. and you're just going to get
a
another Trumpy.
Person.
Yeah, you're going to get somebody.
You're going to get the QAnon shaman.
Yeah, you're going to get the shaman, which is, it's a reasonable observation, but it's not convincing.
Well, yeah, and I just wonder, okay, maybe they think they're propping up whatever shreds of principle the Republican Party has. But like, what practically does that mean? Because on every major policy issue, immigration deals that were basically Republican gimmies, funding for Ukraine, which would have been like just no thought required, 10
years ago.
As Republican policy, they're not getting anything from it other than staying in office to do what Trump's
doing.
Yeah,
but don't undervalue staying in office.
Yeah.
Don't undervalue employment and relevance. I mean, we've talked about this before. Lindsey Graham is very honest about why he switched teams from Team McCain to Team Trump. And he lost, John McCain died, and he lost his patron. And Lindsey Graham told other people, he wants to be relevant. He wants to be in the game. I was with Lindsey Graham once when the president called Trump, and he held up the phone and said, look who's calling.
Right.
That's
it's
important.
A parlor trick.
That's important, to these guys. And so, like, we can't undervalue. Look, we can judge it. But we can't undervalue it as some of them are genuinely concerned. They have young kids and they understand how threatening some of this stuff can be in the atmosphere, from hardcore Trump supporters. And I have a lot of sympathy for that. But on the other hand, you're elected to lead, right? That's the job is to follow your conscience and follow the law and support and uphold the Constitution.
Yeah, and also by keeping Trump in office, they're increasing the likelihood that the threats will be part of the culture of politics in America.
Well, also they're increasing the likelihood that they will eventually lose anyway.
Yes.
That it'll become Rob Portman retired.
Yes.
Don't forget, he left. And one can surmise that he left because he knows what's happening in the party, and he didn't want to deal with a Trump challenger and all the rest.
I want to ask about that because, we can point to on a single hand the number of Republicans who served in elected office or are on their way out, Mitt yeah. Romney among them, Liz
right.
Cheney among them, who have come out and been very forcefully critical of Donald Trump, right?
Right.
Why has that number not been higher? There have been a lot of Republican retirements. There are a lot of Republicans that know better and that have said, you know what, I'm tapping out, I'm done here. Why aren't they trying to save their own party?
So I just think you're dealing with the, nature of complicity, right? We had a great piece a couple of years ago from Ann Applebaum,
yeah.
who is an expert on, Soviet complicity and an authoritarian complicity. And she makes the point, and I hadn't really thought this through the way she had thought it through, that complicity is the norm. That's normal behavior. Being a dissident, being Liz Cheney, that's not normal. We all think in our best moments that, oh, we're going to be the brave truth teller. We're going to, we're going to risk for Mitt Romney, risk eating alone in the Senate dining room because no one wants to sit with you anymore, or risk something far more dangerous. But, the truth is most humans are weak or have long moments of weakness, and they want to fit in and they want to get along and they want to protect their incomes and they want to do all these things that are perfectly understandable. So I think like we think of complicity as this a terrible thing and rare, but it's not. It's the normal
behavior. And I think Ann Applebaum has written so brilliantly about the slide towards autocracy and how we're maybe on the precipice of it ourselves. But we're not talking about normal everyday Americans. We're not talking about people who wanted to be, in advertising or plumbing or whatever. We're talking about people who wanted to be in government because they understood a certain set of principles and wanted to help uphold them.
And that's my point. That's my point in this. It's like you... There are 43 Republicans who voted against conviction, right? If 10 more had joined their Republican colleagues, Mitt Romney among them, and the Democrats, Donald Trump would not be able to run for office right now. They had this moment. And I end the piece by saying, look, I believe if the country goes a certain way, if history goes a certain way, will be raising statues to Mitt Romney. And people like Rob Portman will be lucky if they're forgotten.
Right.
Right. Because that's exactly your point. You're not a plumber. You're not in advertising. You took an oath to uphold the Constitution. And you were there when the Capitol was invaded.
It is, as many things you write are, very, very smart and very essential in these times. And, you know, just, I love The Atlantic forever for the service you do, not just for us as readers, but us as a democracy. So keep it up, boss.
Thank you.
It's good to see you, Jeffrey Goldberg with The Atlantic. Still to come tonight, Donald Trump's new financial lifeline is raising a lot of questions. We will look at some explosive new reporting around its origin story. But first, special counsel Jack Smith is signaling that his patience with slow-walking Judge Eileen Cannon may soon be at an end. That is next.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Very, very late last night, special counsel Jack Smith filed a scathing rebuke of Judge Eileen Cannon, the Trump-appointed federal judge in Florida who's overseeing the former president's criminal prosecution over classified documents. In the filing, Smith excoriated Cannon for entertaining a totally meritless claim, one that could lead directly to either a dismissal of the case or an acquittal for Trump. Smith's frustration here was so palpable that it suggested he may ultimately appeal to a higher court on the matter whenever Judge Cannon makes an actual decision, which could take a while. Since Judge Cannon joined this case, she has amassed a pile of motions, all of which she has yet to rule on. It's a sort of treasure trove of potentially controversial calls. More than 2 months ago, on January 16th, Trump's lawyers asked Cannon to force prosecutors to hand over additional materials they believe would demonstrate the prosecution's ties to the intelligence community. Judge Cannon has yet to rule on that. On February 8th, that's also nearly 2 months ago, Jack Smith's team begged Judge Cannon to reconsider her decision to release unredacted filings to the public, ones that could reveal the names of potential prosecution witnesses. Judge Cannon has yet to rule on that. Nearly 6 weeks ago, on February 22nd, Trump's lawyers filed four separate motions to dismiss the case altogether on a variety of grounds. Though she expressed doubts about some of Trump's arguments, again, nearly 6 weeks ago, Cannon has only ruled on one of them. And then there is the trial date, 32 days and counting since Cannon held a hearing about setting a new date for the trial. Judge Cannon has yet to make that very crucial decision upon which a lot of other things depend. Joining me now is Mary McCord, former senior Justice Department official and co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast. Mary, thank you for helping me understand what can only be termed in layman's terms, of course, insanity that is unfolding down in Florida. I mean, Judge Cannon's inbox must be like piled sky high with things to do. And I'm just wondering how unusual it is for a judge to A, entertain some of these crazy motions, and then B, to take so long to decide them.
So, I mean, a judge has to technically entertain any motion filed, but I think what you're getting at is couldn't some of these be sort of dismissed pretty rapidly, right? Many are not really very serious. They don't need to have an oral argument. They could be decided on the papers. And there's several of those, I think, that she should have decided by now. You have to wonder a little bit if it's this whole question that caused her to order the parties to submit these proposed jury instructions that Jack Smith and Donald Trump submitted last night. You have to wonder if the issue that's caused her to issue that order is what is the reason why she has not ruled on other motions. And what I mean by that is, as both Jack Smith and Donald Trump say in their response, essentially her scenario B that posits that a president's decision when they leave the White House to take papers with them automatically means those papers have been designated as personal under the Presidential Records Act. Her scenario B starts with that legal premise. Both of the parties respond, that's essentially directing a verdict for Donald Trump. That would essentially be saying, so long as Donald Trump knew he was taking records, he necessarily made them personal. They're not then subject to him being criminally prosecuted because that means he has authorized use. So I wonder if in some way she's thinking, let me resolve that first because maybe I go away. Donald Trump is actually arguing this very instruction, this important exercise you made us do shows why now you should go back and you should dismiss this case because it, for one thing, under vagueness, selective prosecution, all these things, but because there just simply is not evidence that he had unauthorized use. So I'm a little worried about the fact that she's sitting on all the other motions, but that's why it's so important that Jack Smith has pretty much promised he will appeal this. You need to rule now because we have to have an opportunity to appeal before a trial starts and jeopardy attaches. And I think he also is saying, and if you don't, we will take it up on mandamus once the trial starts.
Okay, just to without getting to the minutia of the jury instructions, because there's a lot there. The essence, yeah. I think it sounds like what you're saying is Judge Cannon is entertaining this kind of these novel ideas because she may just want an excuse to dismiss this case and be done with the whole thing. And if that is...
That wouldn't surprise me. Yeah.
If that is in fact true and Jack Smith understands that, I mean, what else does he need before he goes to like the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and says, as you say, a writ of mandamus to get a new judge on this case? I mean, the New York Times points out that she has been in a holding pattern on so much of this stuff that he can't appeal anything, right? Like he's waiting for her to make a bad call effectively so that he can go to the higher powers and say, we got to get a new judge. Do you think that that's what's happening here?
So, yes, and I think that's the only reason to now undercut the argument I just made that maybe she's thinking she could get rid of it. I don't know that she wants to get rid of it right now because she will be appealed. I think she kind of wants to delay everything and get rid of it potentially after the trial actually starts, where the government's only option on a jury instruction there would be a mandamus. If she were to grant a motion for acquittal after the presentation of evidence, at the end of the government's case, that would not be appealable. So even at trial, he needs her to say, these are the jury instructions I'm going to give. They're so wrong. They're so erroneous that he could take that up on a petition for mandamus, which is like an appeal sort of in the moment, really immediate, like you need a reversal immediately. So I think you're right. I mean, even when she denied the motion to dismiss on vagueness grounds, which is the only motion you mentioned in your opening that she's ruled on, she said it's without prejudice to renew it again at some future time, which is exactly why you see Donald Trump in his response last night renewing that motion. And we'll see him doing that again at trial if this gets to trial. So Jack Smith is kind of between a rock and a hard place where he doesn't have anything yet that he can appeal or even seek mandamus on, other than potentially arguing she's not ruling on things she needs to rule on. And I think we may see that if she continues to refuse to rule on this.
Okay, so her inaction on this in and of itself may be cause for a writ of mandamus, something that I didn't think we would say with such frequency on cable television. But here we are in Donald Trump's legal America. Mary McCord, thank you for joining us. Thanks for your expertise tonight.
pleasure.
More ahead, including a conservative group working to blur the separation between church and state in public schools across the country. But first, who helped Trump's social media company stay afloat after federal investigators put its lucrative merger plans on pause? Got some stunning new reporting on that coming up next.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
What do all these things have in common? Flirt, the number four, free.com, naked.com, stripchat.com, and Donald Trump. Well, according to new reporting out of The Guardian, they all got money from the same small bank in the Caribbean. I should note, NBC News has not independently confirmed this reporting, and Trump media's response to this reporting was to broadly threaten defamation without contesting specifics. But today, The Guardian reported that it has obtained leaked documents showing that in 2022, Trump Media, the parent company of Trump's Truth Social, received a total of $8 million in loans from a company called ES Family Trust. And ES Trust is actually just a shell company created by the co-owner of a bank in the Caribbean known as Paxim. Paxim is not only a bank primarily known for its work with the online porn industry, it is not even properly licensed to make loans in the United States. And the Russian-American businessman who allegedly arranged that loan is also allegedly under scrutiny in a federal insider trading and money laundering investigation. And the reason Trump's media company needed that $8 million in the first place, despite Trump's claims about being flush with cash, the reason the company needed that cash so quickly was because in 2021, the company had planned to merge with another company for a big cash infusion, but that merger was held up by the SEC because even that deal seemed shady. And it turns out the SEC was right to be suspicious. Today, two of the early investors in the company that Trump Media tried to merge with in 2021 pleaded guilty to securities fraud, or in layman's terms, insider trading that netted them tens of millions of dollars. We are going to get some very expert help with all of the specifics here in just a moment, but let's just zoom out for a second. Truth Social is largely seen as Donald Trump's biggest financial lifeline. Last week, Trump's net worth shot up by more than $4 billion because of his stock in the company. $4 billion because investors believe Trump's media company is a good investment. A media company we now know was in the red to the tune of $58 million last year. So shady loans, insider trading, and a company that is hemorrhaging cash and is somehow Trump's big financial lifeline. What is actually happening here? Joining me now is Drew Harwell, technology reporter at The Washington Post, who has been covering all of this funny money business around Trump Media and Truth Social for years now. Drew, thanks for being with me tonight. I mean, I think, you know, given Trump's claims publicly about how wealthy he is, why is it that a media company affiliated with Trump would be so cash-strapped to the tune of $8 million that they would end up needing to be involving a small Caribbean bank in the year 2021?
Yeah. So, you know, remember back to 2021, Trump is the king of debt and he needed money badly for this company. You know, he was not able to get loans from traditional banks who had seen, you know, years of bankruptcies and failures on that end. January 6th had just happened a couple months prior. And so the company was really struggling. They were trapped in this, you know, mired merger process. They had no idea when it was going to unlock the money they needed. And, you know, suddenly here, this money appeared. And I remember talking to a whistleblower from the company who remembered being really off-put by having this $8 million just sort of show up in their accounts, you know, named to this family trust no one had ever heard of, you know, connected to people that were total strangers to the company. And so it felt very odd that this money just sort of, you know, happened to come out right when they needed it.
What you talk about the people that were sort of involved in this loan. One of them, Anton Postolnikov, I believe, co-owned the bank and arranged, according to The Guardian, at least, the loan. What can you tell us about him and his background?
Yeah, so Anton Postolnikov was born in St. Petersburg, Russia. He's the nephew of a very high-ranking Russian government official for many years, Alexander Smirnov. And, you know, we can see that Postolnikov was involved in this Paxim Bank. As you saw, you know, this was a bank that deals with people who traditional banks typically don't deal with, including in the adult content industry. And Paxim Bank has been very clear that they are very proud to have them as customers. It's not the typical kind of company that would work with Trump or even a Trump media-like company. And so, you know, when Postolnikov was running Paxim Bank, you could see some of these wire transfer documents that I've seen, and I think The Guardian has seen as well, that show the $2 million coming from ES Family Trust. And it shows that Paxim is facilitating those loans. So for a while, we really didn't know what the connection was between ES Family Trust, which had very few fingerprints to trace back to, and Paxim Bank, which was facilitating this loan out of nowhere, except that the one name on the trust was a Paxim employee. Now we know from these, you know, this further reporting that Postolnikov was very involved. And it appears that, you know, he could access the account or right around that time. And so it just raises questions of why this person who, you know, Postolnikov lives in Miami Beach, owns very nice real estate in one of the priciest zip codes in America, why he was getting involved in this business deal out of nowhere.
Hmm. Why would a wealthy businessman with ties to Russia want to be involved with Donald Trump? I'm just going to let that hang there. I'm not going to ask you to answer that, Drew. But the two brothers who pleaded guilty today to insider trading, Michael and Gerald Schwartzman, can you talk about who they are and how they sort of fit into the broader picture of questionable financial dealings?
Yeah. So Michael and Gerald Schwartzman. Gerald Schwartzman owns a furniture store in Miami. Michael Schwartzman is his brother and runs a venture capital firm that, like Postolnikov's Paxim Bank, would deal with marijuana dispensaries of, you know, if that surprises you, you know, by doing these cashless ATMs. So again, these were both people, you know, Postolnikov and Schwartzman dealt with gray market money quite often, and both lived in the Miami area. And they both learned about from Patrick Orlando, who was the head of the company that ended up merging with Trump Media to take it public, learned that this deal was coming. And Postolnikov and the Schwartzman brothers all made exceptionally timed bets based off of this insider trading and insider knowledge and made tens of millions of dollars from it. And that's according to the FBI. And so the Schwartzman brothers, after they made these tens of millions, Michael Schwartzman also tried to hide some of this money, according to the feds. I mean, bought a yacht with it, tried to wash it through all these Swiss bank accounts. And so, you know, their change of plea this week to plead guilty was actually very interesting because it showed that the FBI was onto something. Postolnikov has never been charged, even though in the documents it shows that he made just as much in profits as the brothers have. And so there's been kind of an open question of what's going on there. But, you know, those men were friends. Michael Schwartzman would talk about, you know, knowing a guy, a Russian guy who had a bank in Dominica, who could wash money for Russians and Ukrainians. And so, you know, the feds were obviously looking at this as a money laundering case with seeing all of this money, you know, hop from account to account around the world so it could hide where it came from.
Well, there is certainly a lot more reporting to be done, a lot of questions that need to be answered. Drew Harwell, thank you for your great reporting on this thus far. We look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Still ahead tonight, the Church of Trump, how conservatives are injecting Christianity into public spaces in order to win at the ballot box. One group has now turned to proselytizing to kids in schools. That is next.
What the hell was Biden thinking when he declared Easter Sunday to be Trans Visibility Day? Such total disrespect to Christians, and November 5th is going to be called something else. You know what it's going to be called? Christian Visibility Day, when Christians turn out in numbers that nobody has ever seen before.
Before polls closed in Wisconsin's Republican primary election yesterday, Donald Trump stood in a room packed with supporters and promised them retribution. Now, he has done this a lot. But this time it wasn't retribution for his four criminal indictments. It wasn't for the $500 million he owes in civil penalties. It wasn't for what he calls political persecution. This time, Trump suggested that President Biden's recognition of Trans Visibility Day on Easter weekend amounted to a persecution of Christians, and promised they would see retribution on Election Day. Christian Visibility Day was Trump's poll-closing message in Green Bay. And surprising exactly no one, the presumptive Republican nominee then won that primary by a landslide. We don't know how much the message of Christian persecution influenced Trump's victory there, but we do know that Trump has managed to turn his Christian followers into politically pious voters, members of the Church of Trump. And those voters are motivated by issues like abortion to put their evangelical hero back in the White House. But that effort has been frustrated by the reality that even in red states like Ohio, efforts to enshrine the right to abortion into state constitutions have been wildly and consistently successful, largely because of the densely populated deep blue cities in those states. And so turning those cities less blue, maybe even purplish, is now a priority. Cities like Columbus, Ohio, where former Ohio State Buckeyes defensive lineman Joel Penton lives. In 2018, Penton launched a group called LifeWise Academy, which provides off-campus Bible studies to public elementary school students during the school day. It is raising serious questions about the separation of church and state. Penton has expanded his mission to put God back in the public school day, and he credits his newfound motivation to Ohio's victorious abortion ballot measure.
When I see what just happened in my state with the new amendment in for Ohio for abortion, it is not only incredibly sad, it's also incredibly motivating. It makes us realize with LifeWise, wow, our mission is all the more important. What other hope do we have but to inject the word of God into the hearts of the next generation? We see the fruit of taking it out of a few generations. We've got to get it back to the next generation.
Penton's LifeWise Academy is currently influencing the minds of public school kids in progressive cities like Columbus. But he wants his Bible studies company to reach every public school in America, which means that blue islands, cities like Tampa and Philadelphia, Las Vegas and Phoenix and Atlanta, those blue islands in red states and swing states like Florida and Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona and Georgia, they could be swayed by LifeWise. And that really could determine what happens at the ballot box. NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton went to Columbus, Ohio to learn more.
As classmates head to the library, this group of Whitehall School District students in Ohio put on matching shirts, board a bus, and head half a mile down the road to church. There, elementary students like Emmanuel and Savannah Brady pray and study scripture.
He approached the Philistine.
This is LifeWise Academy, a nonprofit bringing the Bible back into the public school day.
The learning really helps you learn about Jesus and what happened in the past.
How popular would you say it is at school?
Mainly, like, the whole class is, like,
over at LifeWise.
Ohio mom Sarah Myers says that LifeWise does exert pressure. She's a Christian with a daughter in a school and partnering with them. No, she won't ever let her take part, though. Yes.
It is all above board until it's not. No school staff person does anything until they do.
Chapters promised ice cream or popcorn parties if kids got their friends to sign up. Another Ohio mom sent NBC News this note her child received from a classmate on LifeWise letterhead, pre-written to say, "My favorite part of class is," the classmate writing everything and inviting the child to join LifeWise. LifeWise told NBC News that like many youth groups, they offer incentives for students and families to learn more, and that they are no different from other organizations that advocate for the policies they believe in.
What do you think LifeWise is trying to do?
Influence, slant, if you will, public schools.
After the break, I'll talk to Antonia about what LifeWise has accomplished so far and what it is planning next.
Do you think church has a place in school?
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to bring churches back into schools for a long time.
Some of these sessions take place when library periods would be happening in school. Mm-hmm. And are you worried about your kids missing out on that experience?
Not at all. I mean, there's 39 books in the Old Testament and 27 books in the New Testament.
LifeWise Academy, an Ohio-based Christian nonprofit, found a legal way to offer Bible lessons to thousands of school children during the school day. Their initial goal was to serve 25 schools by 2025. But by the start of this year, they had already set up chapters in more than 300 schools in a dozen states, teaching the gospel to 35,000 public school students during school hours on a weekly basis. Joining me now is Antonia Hilton, NBC News correspondent. Antonia, every time you visit here, I get a distressing picture of what's happening elsewhere in the country, and this is not any exception.
I'm sorry to stress you out.
No, it's really important and essential reporting, and I just wonder how. First of all, how is for people who are a little bit unclear as to how this arrangement works, when and how are these kids being taken out of public school and sent to Bible study effectively?
Yes, and I'm sure people want to know too. Wait, one more time, how is this legal?
Yeah.
So LifeWise has the support, frankly, of a number of Supreme Court rulings, and they're able to make this work through three things. It has to be optional, so kids have to opt in. You can't have a school district that's forcing everyone to be in LifeWise. It can't be on the school property. So usually LifeWise sets up at a church that's really close by. I mean, the one we went to was about a half a mile ride. It's like nothing. And then, it can't take place when there would be a math or a science class, something seen as essential. So kids are coming out of things like recess, or in the case of the students you just saw there, they're leaving their library periods. And in that district, about 50% of the kids are leaving.
Wow.
So, you're seeing a large portion of, the classmates or friends that you might be with in that section leave at that time. And it does have an impact, at least visually, on the school environment.
Well, and they're all wearing their red shirts, and there are popcorn parties that LifeWise is having. And then there are these notes that these kids pass each other about how great and how fun LifeWise is. I mean, I just wonder if this is not running afoul of some First Amendment stuff, like whether or not there's kind of a gray area here that may be further explored by people who find this questionable in terms of the
separation. I talked all about that gray area with the administrator at the school district to say, how are you walking this tightrope?
Yeah.
Are you worried about lawsuits? Is this a stress for you? And he acknowledged they are walking a very fine line here. Schools can't encourage or establish a religion.
Yeah.
But they also can't stop kids from expressing their faith. And so with these instruction policies, these released time religious instruction policies is what you see at the district level here, and states like Ohio have allowed their schools to do this. It means that once those policies are in place, school districts kind of have to put their hands up and allow programs like LifeWise, and other groups could do this too. It's just that LifeWise seems to have kind of figured out the
franchise
here.
Model.
Yeah. Yeah. But they are supposed to, without encouraging or discouraging it, allow the kids to go and then to come back. The trouble comes when we talk to people in these communities, parents and observers who are getting concerned about LifeWise. They tell us that that all sounds fine, but in practice, it's messier than that.
Yeah.
They have seen administrators hand out paperwork and flyers about LifeWise. In one school district in Ohio, a tutor gave a Hindu student information about LifeWise. And that's interpreted by a lot of parents, even Christian parents. I mean, kids who with kids who go to Sunday school and are part of this community. They're getting uncomfortable and they feel like there is this kind of encroachment happening that even if it all looks clean on paper, isn't how it actually functions on the ground.
And isn't that sort of the point of LifeWise? I mean, we had that sound from the founder saying, you know, he got particularly motivated by Ohio's, you know, enshrining of abortion rights. And politics is a part of this, right? It's not just to spread the gospel. There is an end to this. There is a goal here at the end of the day.
Another blurry line, right?
Yeah.
Because LifeWise itself is not a political organization. These are elementary school students. In my observations, I haven't seen them talk about politics or tell those kids to vote a particular way, of course. But when you see who they associate with, you do start to raise questions, right? So LifeWise last summer had a teacher summit, and Patriot Mobile, a group that many of your viewers would be familiar with, because we've talked about it a few times. They are a openly far-right Christian organization that supported and funded this event. Then you see Joel Penton, the founder, go on a program. And it's, you know, you start to see that kind of political association.
You see the sort of roots or maybe the treetops of where this is all going or coming from. Antonia, amazing reporting. NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton. Thank you for your time tonight. That is our show for this evening.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.